You're listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network, now the largest new media platform on the web, and your number one source for after-show entertainment. The AfterBuzz Studios in Los Angeles, California. Presented by Maria Menounos and Bing.com. And streaming live thanks to Akamai Technologies. This is AfterBuzz TV's Teen Wolf After Show. We'll break down tonight's episode and get you all the latest news and gossip. And now, another post-game wrap-up show for your favorite TV show. It's AfterBuzz TV's Teen Wolf After Show.
Hello, AfterBuzzers. Bing is for doing, and we're here doing another AfterBuzz TV after show for MTV's Teen Wolf Season 3, Episode 7, Currents. I'm Kristen Elizabeth Snyder, your host. Sitting next to me, Sarah Stretton, AfterBuzz TV host.
Hi, guys.
Across the table, we have assistant editor Corey Trench.
Hello, how you doing?
And our
very handsome Corey.
I forgot a few adjectives. Our special guest this evening created and directed groundbreaking music videos that expanded the scope of the music video industry and shaped the way we looked at music videos today. Music videos were originally straight performance videos, but he brought vision to music video world and started the idea of filming mini features with the full production value. Matching imagery to a beat and enhancing the songs with his unique vision, he created and directed music videos for Kim Carnes, Elton John, Billy Joel, Queen, The Rolling Stones, Fleetwood Mac, Rod Stewart, Def Leppard, The Human League, Duran Duran, AC/DC, just to mention a few of my favorites. He created and directed music video for Video Killed the Radio Star, which became the first music video played on MTV ever in 1981. He directed movies such as Highlander, Tale of a Mummy, Residential Evil, Extinction, TV shows such as Skin, Tales from the Crypt, and most recently is the director and co-executive producer of MTV's Teen Wolf. Please welcome Russell Mulcahy.
Thank you.
I had to say all that.
Did I write that or you write that? What thou?
I had to say all that just because I want people to recognize who they're listening to this evening. What accomplishments.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. This is an amazing set of accomplishments, and clearly you bring a huge contribution to why we all love Teen Wolf.
Well, yeah, Teen Wolf is definitely a passion. I became very good friends with its developer and creator and its mastermind, Jeff Davis, and we became very good friends 3 years ago when we ventured on the pilot, and we didn't know. We had this thing. He had this thing in his hands, and I joined him, and we just went for it. And it's a thing of passion.
It's so crazy because to me, I mean, I listen to your band, I'm just like, wow, the stories. But changing just the format from music videos to film to TV, I feel like when you look at music videos and film, you get a whole picture. It's the beginning to the end. But you go into these TV shows, and you kind of have to go in with a vibe, but you never really know the outcome. Like, how does your directing standpoint change for that?
Oh, well, I think with, like, for example, like you said, I started off with music videos. Actually, I was a film editor at a TV station cutting the news. And then I started doing music videos off the hand or as a sideline, and then I became known for doing those. And they were like my film school. I was doing like little mini features, and each one was different. They would send me a song that I would just come up with an idea, and each one had its own individual personality. But they were sort of projects because I was a frustrated feature filmmaker, and I just sort of make these little mini feature films. And like I remember like MTV, one of the early videos I sent to them, I started cropping the top and bottom of the frame with black. Mm-hmm. And to make them look like a movie, you know? the old TVs were 4x3,
right?
So I'd crop them, and they would ring me up and say, "We have a technical problem. There's black." I said, "No, we're blowing it up." I said, "No, it's meant to look like that. It's meant to look like a film." And like we're Hungry Like a Wolf and all those sort of ones, those sort of videos I did. And so then I got into feature films, Highlander, and they let me go wild on that and. And the whole history of Ricochet and The Shadow and Resident Evil. And I was doing a film for Showtime with Sigourney Weaver, Prayers for Bobby. Mm-hmm. And it was around that time that Jeff called me up and said, you know, do you want to come in for a meeting about this project, Teen Wolf, MTV? I went, oh, my God. I was I used to sort of like MTV was back in my past. I go, like before my first film, Razorback, was like, you know, like you said, Video Killed the Radio Star. And there I was back down in Santa Monica at MTV. Mm-hmm. And
they wanted you back.
Yeah, and it was basically love at first sight. It's a genre I love.
Mm-hmm.
He is a fabulous creative talent, and we just bonded, and you know, we had this mantra of sexy, scary, and surprising. You know, we wanted to up the antes, and
that's the perfect combination, I think.
Yeah, I think maybe this season we're going this. The scare factor is being ramped up.
Absolutely. Yeah. And speaking of upping the ante, 307 was just, very much ambitious and incredible episode. I mean, just talking about the loft scene, I know when you got shot that was a huge undertaking. That's when Kali and Derek square off.
I was going to ask what the biggest challenge was of directing this episode. For the viewers who don't know, Russell actually did direct this episode this evening.
Well, every episode is challenging. We shoot them fast and they're furious, and but we have a wonderful family of creative people that just work hard and love the show. But last night's episode was physically challenging. We flooded the set, we waterproofed the set, we gallons of water in that thing for like 3 days, and you know, it all had to be sort of safe with all the lights and everything, and everyone's walking around in gum boots for 3 days, sloshing around. But Kali, God bless her, she was in bare feet. That water was cold. That was
really
cold. And she was bare feet the whole way.
The entire time.
And the floor started to get really slimy.
Uh-oh.
And she slipped a few times.
But yeah.
She's a trooper, yeah.
Well, let's go ahead and get into tonight's episode, and starting off with the 10-car pileup and all the people in the ER with Scott's mom and the doctors. And we got that scene with the moths sort of taking people away, and I wanted to talk about the moth symbolism and its meaning about impending danger, and apparently they're an omen of death in some cultures.
See, I totally missed out on the fact that they're moths. I was like, The butterflies are attacking the people. So the fact that they're moths actually is probably better, because I think moths in general creep people out.
They
more
were very
than the happy
creepy. I thought it was going to be like a Silence of the Lambs type deal, where like people were suffocating due to the moths in their throat. But it turned out that it was because they were suspended and they needed the strength to lift themselves up in order to breathe.
And I liked how they related that to, like, the line where she brought that back to the fact that was how people died during crucifixions, which I just like all the, like, little added bits of history and actual, like, knowledge that the show puts in each episode.
Jeff told me once that, you know, he created Criminal Minds, and in every show of Teen Wolf, there are little bits of little facts, and in Criminal Minds, they used to call them Jeff's fun facts. I think we have them on in Team Wolf. That every week you'll get a little bit of bing. Oh, I learned something today.
apart from
being like entertained the hell out of you, you also learn something.
I love that aspect because
I think it's cute. Yeah.
I will get done watching the show and I will go to Google and I like want to learn more about the telluric currents or the geometric waves of the Earth and the lunar eclipse.
That's all true. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's werewolves running around the forest, but the other stuff is true.
Hey, I have nothing to prove that that's not true.
I'm not discounting werewolves either, actually.
And just speaking of the moths, though, I kind of want to go into, because you were very involved in this, the Eden did our visual effects for all the moths. And that was something I know you wanted to pay close attention to. Can you talk a little bit about like what you were looking for maybe with...
Well, to me, the best visual effects are ones that they don't pop out as unreal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... So basically, I just wanted to look as real as possible. I've had experience where you tried to use real moths or real flies and other, like Tales of the Crypt, one time we tried to use Actually, this is.
I love Tales of the Crypt.
No, this is too
Please talk
story.
About it. I love it. Everyone loves
what?
That
no,
show.
No, they want to know. They want to know. Yeah.
Okay, there was an episode of Tales of the Crypt where there was a character who was. Had someone, he's a brother attached to him, but he shot his brother, so he was rotting in the back. His brother was dead. But he's selling ice cream to kids. And at the end of the show, the camera pulls back, and the brother on the back who's rotting away, the place is meant to be full of flies. So I said, okay, we'll get a fly wrangler. I was really naive when I was doing this show. So on a Sunday morning, we're downtown, and the fly wrangler turns up. And this is before CG. And he opens up his trunk and he says, we have a little problem. And he said, and there were like these like six dead rabbits. And they're all like sort of moving a little. And he said, the larvae you haven't quite popped yet.
Oh my God.
So needless to say.
And so that's how they used to do it.
No, I don't think anyone's ever done that. I think I was just really stupid.
That's an amazing story.
I mean, yeah.
He wanted some real flies in there. Come on.
Well, I wanted, yeah, the real thing. But,
yeah.
But, yeah. Thank God for CG.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like we got to move the Greek yogurt bar so people don't think we're crazy.
Is that long enough, Ed? It's delicious.
I said we need Pepsi and Twizzlers, right?
And Starbucks.
For the episode. So I wanted to talk about Scott being selfless in the beginning, where he is showing his good character once again and why he is the one true alpha when he kind of absorbs the pain from that woman in the ER. Like, he had no reason to do that, and he just sat down, and that's him having to endure the pain, correct? Like, he has to suffer it then.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he absorbs it.
Mm-hmm.
I think this episode is kind of great because it talks about Scott being that virtuous person, and then Deaton pointing that out to him, like, you are this virtuous figure, and this is why you are becoming the true alpha. So, yeah, that's just another example of Scott's virtue and wanting to take on other people's pain, which I thought was a good metaphor in general, because I think he takes on the burden of a lot of his pack, if you will. Mm-hmm. So
with Isaac living with him. And
exactly. I think he's sort of like a Christ figure almost, in that he just sort of takes on all the whole masses and just different people that need help. You know, anyone that needs help, Scott's always there for them. So that's just another example of what
that's
what
kind
he
of
does.
The statement of Teen Wolf. I feel like it promotes the good, and it's such a great example for teenagers who love the show to see that that's the lead character that they're rooting for, and he's the one who's always like the good guy and trying to, you know, remain pure, if you would, and do the right thing and make the right decisions.
He's always so humble about everything, and like, you would see that also in his relationship with his mother this episode, like when she was the one to save Danny, like, he, you saw him be thankful for her. You saw him, like, look up to his mom. And
as, like, she was a real hero. Like, they're used to seeing all these supernatural things, but it was like, for once, they saw someone who was human doing something, saving a life, and it's like, they were in awe because of that. That was a great scene, talking about Danny. Also, I thought they might have to turn Danny because of his health issues, and I was like, we don't want him to die, so I was thinking perhaps they were going to bite him, and I don't know if that's going
to
come in the future.
Rescue, yes. Yeah.
My original thought when he was limping in was that they were going to reveal a bite. I was like, you're bringing a bite into the hospital? What's going on? And then, of course, it ended up being the mistletoe, but I was like, oh, I guess that would make more sense.
So the twins kind of reveal that they were, you know, staged kind of the she's all that to date Lydia and Danny, and they find out that, you know, Danny's not the important one, I guess, but that it's Lydia. So do you think they have to be worried now about Lydia's safety, because they said they were trying to find out who was important to Scott?
I mean, I feel like if they're really trying to find out who's important to Scott, like, hurting either one of them kind of does the trick, just because he would go to the rescue of anyone. But what more I got from that is, one, that they are going to target Lydia, but do they have actual feelings for them? Because
I feel
watching
like
their relationships, I feel like each of the twins really does, like, have an attraction and a want to be with them. So are they just playing mind games? Is this just something, like, Duke Callion has, like, ordered them to do? Or, like, are they developing emotional attachments.
I think it's just that. I think it was originally in order, but obviously there are both attractive people, Danny and Lydia, so it kind of just comes with it, and they're good people as well, so I think that they're falling in love.
But, I mean, they've shown in the past that they're willing to kill all their packs, so they should be, they're probably willing to kill their significant others if ordered.
Well, yeah, it's interesting how, like, in the supernatural elements of Teen Wolf, there is the human element. And then, you know, I also wanted to ask, you know, that human element comes out in the acting. And then as a director, you know, how do you sort of work with the actors to bring out their characters when they're performing?
We've been working with these actors now for 3 seasons, and they're growing, their roles are growing, they're growing, they're developing and evolving. Mm-hmm. And the relationship between Scott and his mum is very different from season 1 that it is now.
Yeah.
And, you know, she now knows her son is a werewolf. Mm-hmm. And it's very cool that she's, like, taken that on and accepted that, and that she loves her son so much, and it's basically strengthened their relationship in a way. And I love that relationship that, you know, Scott has with his mum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know that she's part of the team now. You
and
know,
Scott
there's nothing to hide.
Says that in this episode, mm. He like has the line where he's like telling her has made our relationship stronger mm. when he's talking mm-hmm. to Styles about telling Styles his father.
Yes,
and bringing him into this.
Let's go ahead and talk about that. Let's get into the Where's Deaton topic. And we do get that scene, which Corey actually edited, where Styles...
Beautiful job.
Beautiful oh, job you. When they're thank on you. The opposite sides of the cage. And it's like at that yes. moment, they're yes. at opposing sides. They're kind of... Scott is kind of saying, you have to tell him, it'll bring him closer to you. And Styles is like, no, I want to leave him in the dark. Like, not telling him will protect him. And that he's my father. I don't want to lose both my parents. And Scott's like, you're right. And then Styles is like, no, I'm not. And I love, can you talk about that, Corey, and kind of the editing
yeah.
of that scene?
Well, yeah. You know, I did the first pass on the scene, and, you know, the performances were just really strong. You know, Dylan and Tyler just sort of brought this sort of like, great weightedness to like the performances, you know, especially Dylan, you know, coming to terms with the fact that, you know, he, you know, should he tell his father and then, you know, risk the consequences of that, but also knowing that, you know, it has to be done. Scott's sort of that catalyst to that. But yeah, no, that scene was just, you could see it in metaphorically in the shooting of it, because when they're behind
cages.
The cages were sort
mm-hmm.
of like,
yeah.
that sort of like activated that.
It was a deliberate visual image
mm-hmm.
to take them into that room and put them behind the cat cages, basically to give that barrier,
right,
as a symbolic barrier to break. And and it's nice to look for those subtle imagery that is not obtrusive but sort of adds to the scene.
Yeah,
absolutely. I was really happy that we got that emotional scene with Scott and Styles again, because last week's was so emotional with the Styles stepping into the gasoline with Scott.
I'm your brother.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I kind of felt that. And they both did look still a little teary-eyed in this scene as well. So it took me back to last week, which added even more weight to this scene. And I was so happy that we got that, because I did feel like they were drifting this season and that Isaac was stepping in on Styles' friendship and kind of getting in the middle of them. So well, I hope that we continue to see these moments with those two.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. A lot of moments. And I just
feels.
Feels. A lot of feels.
Hashtag.
I saw that on Twitter, actually, during that scene. There was a hashtag that said Stilinski family feels, and it was like trending, so people were really responding to it.
Really?
Yeah, no, they were like really feeling that scene, because who can't relate to, you know, wanting to protect your family and stuff like that. But before I just want to, before I forget to mention, the entire episode, of course, edited by Edward R. Abrams, ACE, my editor, the one I assist, you know, he did of course a fantastic job. I mean, especially with the loft scene and everything, and the just like terrific editing.
And we love Ed. I hope he's coming in episode 11 to break down
yes,
that episode
yes.
with us.
He's probably still cutting it
Yeah, probably still at work.
Hi, Ed. Keep cutting.
Good job, Ed. So how do you think Sheriff Zelinsky will react to his son telling him? I mean, it definitely helps having the law on your side, right? I don't feel like him knowing would be a bad thing. What do you think, Sarah?
I mean, I'm a little torn between, like, what I predict is going to happen and what I don't. Because, obviously, I want Styles and his dad to keep their good relationship. And having someone who is part of the law is going to help them keep it a secret. And it's also going to help his dad with his job. But we kind of already saw... We already saw Scott's mom be okay with it. So I'm really going to see another parent be okay with
it. And we saw Chris Argent kind of going through the struggle of finding out Allison was dating a werewolf. So who he's sworn to protect. You know what? Yeah, I don't know. I feel like out of all those parents, Zelinsky is probably the warmest guy. And I feel like he would kind of not want to believe it, but eventually it would bring Styles and his father closer together. And I'm excited for that talk because, you know, it was teased this episode and it definitely needs to happen, I'm guessing, next episode. So let's go ahead and get into whenever Deaton's sister, Miss Morell, shows up. And she kind of gives them a clue. She's like, I'm going to help you find my brother. And they're like, no problem, we'll help you. And she's like, no, I'm going to help you. She was like,
really
not no emotional either. She like was not emotional, like, here. She wasn't even trying to help. Like, what's going on there with her relationship with her brother?
I just want to know what her and her brother are. And then I feel like I'd be able to talk about it so much easier.
But she was kind of acting like Deucalion and like, I'm going to give you a clue, but I'm not really going to help you. But this is your brother. So it's like, are you not really his sister?
I think it has to be something about they're only supposed to get so involved. Mm-hmm. At least that's where I placed it in my mind, because we saw Deaton when he's on the phone with Scott saying, right, I thought I would never have to put you in this position.
Right, that's a great
and
point.
And he's known what Scott is. Like, he's been involved but never pressing the line. And when he, like, broke that with that phone call, I thought that that was, like, a kind of a big step. So the fact that his sister is still reserved or semi-reserved, I think it more of has to deal with what they are or how they know everything they seem to know.
That's a good point. And when she said that there's someone who can help you who has supernatural abilities, of course Styles thinks of Lydia right away because he's always thinking of Lydia. But did she mean Deucalion? Because Lydia really wasn't any help with the Ouija board and the keys and the drawings. I mean, she really didn't give him anything.
I think that she did mean Lydia. Mm-hmm. I think that, personally, I think that her drawing of the tree is actually going to be very important. And they just don't understand it yet.
Right.
I think it's going to be something that they revisit later. But overall, for this episode, Lydia didn't really seem to help that much. So,
how do you think Deucalion knows the location of Deaton? Is it because he has visions, because he's blind, or is it because he has a map too?
I know we can't turn to you guys because you guys won't give it away. But in my mind, this is my biggest question right now is, who knows what, and how are they connected, and how, and what level of knowledge do each of them have? Because I think we've grasped at the point that obviously the Argents have a story to tell, and that even the people in that family are operating at different levels of knowledge, and it's coming out. And who's he going to tell this story to?
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be Allison? Is it who knows? So we have that, and then we have also Deucalion and all of his team. And I want to know where they line up, where they connect. Are they sharing information? Is this a plot together? But to me, it's a giant question.
Well, I think that's one of the very entertaining things about this show, is that it's like this extraordinary jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
Not only is each episode like, has like three different storylines going along at once, and you're each going at the same time, and you're jumping from one story to the next, and da da da, and then each road eventually joins and meets at the end. But amongst that, that's in the smaller picture, and the bigger picture, there is this bigger jigsaw puzzle, which is finally the pieces are coming together. And they will.
Yeah.
And then,
just wait.
Yeah. Some good surprises coming.
We have to learn along the way.
But my God, you are paying good attention.
I try.
So is it that Lydia still can't control her supernatural abilities, or do you think it's just a matter of her owning it, like Scott?
Like some self-acceptance?
Self-acceptance with Scott accepting to be the one true alpha and, like, Lydia accepting her supernatural abilities. Do you think she just can't control it yet, or it's a matter of her not owning it?
I think it's definitely a matter of her being in denial of being some
psychic.
Being an amazing artist, by the way. That's sketch.
Yes, the tree. She's very good at drawing trees.
Very good at drawing trees.
Yes.
That's what I learned.
Yeah.
Hopefully she saves those drawings in case we have to compare them later.
Yes. What is so weird about this is that we're filmed all 12 episodes, and we start shooting the next 12 in next week.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. I've just come from a production meeting. And you're asking questions, and we sort of know the answers, and we can't say a thing.
Can't say anything.
We'll see you in a couple of weeks, you'll be like, ha-ha-ha.
I'm wondering what questions are going to get solved this 12. And is there going to be a break on MTV before we get the second 12? Is there going to be a hiatus?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It won't be as long, probably.
No, not as long.
I don't know the official time.
Yeah, I don't know the official air date for the next 12, but I don't think
it'll be shorter break.
It will be a shorter break, right. Mm-hmm. So you'll be able to, you know, you'll feel a little anxious at first, but it'll be coming soon. Your questions will be answered on that. I'm like, no, I just want more. And it's like, you'll get more. Don't believe me.
I have so many. Like, I feel like in episode 3, I was waiting for Deucalion to shift, and it still hasn't happened.
The demon wolf is coming. Do you think if Styles was to become a werewolf, he would actually get the girl, a.k.a. Lydia?
I hadn't thought of this at all.
What do you think, Ori? Would he get the girl becoming a werewolf?
Oh, gosh, wow. I've never thought about that before.
I feel like it's not going to have to be up to him being a werewolf.
I don't think he's that concerned with that whole thing. You know, he's just solving crimes at this moment in time.
I mean, it's not a priority, but I feel like when people have become a werewolf, it's sort of, you know...
It comes with... becoming a werewolf comes with its baggage.
Yes, definitely.
And I'm not sure whether Styles wants that baggage.
But it does help their lives a lot, too.
Absolutely.
And I feel like that's something he's always wanted. So I didn't know if it would make him, you know, more attractive to her now that he has all these powers and is strength.
I feel like we have to look at Boyd in this instance and how that's what he sought. And it did not end too well. Although he said it was worth it or whatnot.
Yeah, in the end.
He did die.
Corey, you were going to say something.
But with Aiden, you know, being a werewolf, Lydia's also drawn to him in such a... And she knows that he's...
She loves the villains. I like
one of the villains. Yeah.
I understand.
Bad boys.
They're now bad boys.
I mean, she liked Jackson.
Yeah.
The lizard.
But she was drawn to both of them before they became supernatural.
But what I think is interesting...
Or before she knew they were supernatural.
What I think is interesting, as opposed to Jackson, I think Lydia takes more control of the relationship. Because in that scene, she like turns him away.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, that's interesting.
She has grown.
Yeah. She's like kind of owning that.
Yeah, I think she's brilliant, and her power... I'm not sure that it's going to be strength, but she's so smart. I just feel like she's her own strength in being, you know, a lot wiser. Like she says to Aiden in that scene, you know, that's exactly what two dumb students would say who are about to get burned to death.
That was such a funny scene.
I mean, right there, she's putting herself on a level above him.
Mm.
And she's clearly the one in control in that scene. So I wanted to go next to the Deucalion Scott scene, which Corey again edited and also supervised by Ed, who edited the entire episode. Deucalion kind of confirms for us that the Alpha Pack was not involved with the Druids, but he wants Scott to kind of like impress him or try to get the cane from him, and then he'll tell him the location. How was editing this scene, Corey?
Oh, gosh. You know, it was so much fun, you know, editing a fight scene. You know, it's kind of funny because it's a fight scene, but it's also a game of keep away. It's like a little cat and mouse sort of thing. So, like, you get all the cool flips and the cool moments, and you just kind of pick, you know, what those moments are, and you just put it together. And then you know, you try to, as much as possible, just cover up the fact that, you know, obviously the stunt doubles, you know. But it was quite a fun scene. That was a really fun scene just to put together. Because not only is this the first time that we've seen Scott do his aerobics, like I've never seen him. I mean, aside from the fact in 201 he does that huge leap across the chasm,
right? Mm-hmm.
That's probably the only time I've seen him do something like a huge leap like that. Mm. But having him do the flip was kind of cool too. But also the other great part about it is this is the first time Deucalion and Scott have fought. They've fought together. Mm-hmm. And
it was more of an elegant fight.
Yeah,
right.
It was more of a gentleman's sort of challenge, yeah?
Yes.
Like a duel or sort of a samurai thing. And I was sort of had a cool factor about it.
I just feel like he's like fencing or something.
Right.
It's that very like, or if you ever watched.
Yeah, but it had that sort of like,
had
that Japanesey music.
Yeah, the music by Dino was really great.
Dino is, yeah, extraordinary.
I think what we've learned is don't go in the music room. Bad thing.
I love the music room, though. It's always my favorite scene.
But I think that fight sequence, we had about an hour. I think I had about an hour and a half to shoot that.
Wow.
Which sometimes I think I put my rock and roll hat on and turn my hat backwards and I go, okay, let's go for it. The adrenaline factor kicks in and you shoot it fast. Yeah, it becomes rock and roll. It's good.
So you're also there directing the stunt doubles as well as the characters themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So are
But Scott's in there quite a lot. If you look closely, Scott does quite a lot of that action.
Yeah. He does.
Yeah. Like Hecklund. Hecklund's, it's hard to pull him away sometimes. He says, no, you are not jumping. You are not. So get down.
That's great.
Yeah.
So we have Allison and Scott getting closer in the closet, and I feel like their situations are kind of
I love that scene.
Pushing them back together, it's right? Their situations, the universe wants them together, and she, keeps it almost.
Do we want them together?
I feel like they've got priorities right now, and they should just, like, let it work out when it's going to work out. And I don't want to push it because we're kind of busy right now. We don't have time for romance. We're working.
Ally team.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's bringing them closer together, is being able to respect each other and the level of work that they do and how they both can contribute to both the issues. Because before, Allison wasn't a huge part of it, and then finding out her family history and everything, she has a major role now. And then with Gerard coming in the picture, she is obviously going to be a window for Scott to get to that world and find out secrets. So I also wanted to talk about the map and how Argent, has like these 12 markings, and where basically Beacon Hills is a beacon, and it's got like these energy fields where there's a lot of energy coming in, especially it's affected by the lunar eclipse. And so they know where the bodies are going to be found. And I'm guessing it's because like the moon obviously brings in extra power, and so that's helping with the sacrifices that the druid is trying to get these special powers from. But how does Argent have this info? Is it from Gerard, or like this map with the UV wand? How did he get that?
I liked the UV wand. But I think that's part of our question, and I think that we are getting that at least some of this knowledge is coming from Gerard.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also been tracking them. We've watched how he went to the Derek's fight scene when he thought Derek was dead. Like, we know he's snooping around. We saw him show up at one of the sites where the body was found, too. So I think he is doing footwork, but I think he's also maybe getting hints or knows a slice from Gerard.
Right, because we get that scene where he's like, next time you're going to tell me the truth. So he's obviously giving him pieces of the story, but not everything. And I really enjoyed that Styles and Danny dream sequence scene where he was telling Danny to take responsibility for his dreams and that this was
a dream. Yeah.
That was funny.
How is it directing Styles character? I feel like everyone just loves him.
Well, I have to say just generally we are blessed with an extraordinary cast. Mm-hmm. But Dylan is just an extraordinary gentleman. young man and an extraordinary actor. That scene is quite wonderful. And the fact that you can hold on a shot where you can like leave frame, keep the other character out of focus, and he'll pop back up into frame, and his the slightest reactions, his timing is quite impeccable.
So
delight to work with, but delight with the rest of the cast.
I know it's a comedy and delivering.
Very lucky.
And delivering comedic lines is a lot about the timing. Is there any like bad habits that you've come across in actors in general that you find it hard to break that they have? Not even on this show, but just in general, a bad habit that you have to somehow break to direct them?
I can't think of anything right now.
When they say line, they don't remember the line.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, no, I mean, sometimes it happens with all actors, and then you know, I mean. Sometimes they'll go off script, you know. They'll go away and they'll go into a bit of improvisation, and it's okay for a couple of takes, and then you'll say, okay, let's do one as written.
Get back to the script.
Otherwise, Jeff is not going to be happy.
right.
But they're allowed a couple of takes where, yeah, okay, go for it if we've got time.
Yeah, right.
So Danny has this map, too, and it's because of his...
He's a brainiac.
His homework and his project that he did for Mr. Harris's class, the Tellurical Currents.
Yes.
Tellurical.
And Mr. Harris made some comments on that, yes.
Yeah, and...
Not suitable for class.
No, not suitable for class at all.
So Danny was on to something. How does Dan... Is this just, like, by chance that he was writing this paper? Does Danny know something? Does he have a supernatural power like Lydia?
I mean... I was stalking it up to chance, but I didn't realize he would be so affected by mistletoe either, so
right.
Who knows?
And we eventually find out that Deaton is in the vault, and Scott's going to go save Deaton. But I thought that Scott was going to have to choose between Derek and Deaton, but it turns out that they can send Cora.
Luckily, he has friends.
Yes.
Yeah, this isn't a Dark Knight scenario. You don't have to choose. You can have both.
Or supposedly, you can have both.
Supposedly. Oh, right. There's, yeah, not without consequence, as seen in this episode.
I loved the superhero Jeep scene where, like, Lydia looks over at Styles.
Yeah.
And, like, that music. It's like, the heroes are on the way.
Yeah, great.
I felt it. I loved it.
There's a whole sort of like, great range of music in last night's episode. I mean, even if you talk about the scene with Styles in the hospital, mm-hmm. it actually was very reminiscent of 60s, The Saint. So there's a great sort of like mixture of music, yeah.
Yeah,
Since you've had such a history and worked in music, do you ever go into like Dino and Laura and say like I have a suggestion or you know? Do you work with them at all?
Occasionally, but Dino's really got such a grip on the show, mm-hmm. and again, Jeff has great passion. For music too, and so the scenes can be very emotional and very sort of scary, and also sometimes just very big and wonderful and sort of cinematic. And I think like for example, the end of last night's episode after Sinquar Boyd dies, mm-hmm. I think his score there is so. Operatic in a way. It nearly becomes like a Greek tragedy. I really dug it. It was quite a wonderful score.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the biggest challenge because, you know, we might not have spent as much time with Boyd as we had the other characters. And I think in his death, you know, I think probably one of the big challenges was like, you know, how do we feel sorry for this character we might not have spent as much time with? But the score, like you say, Russell, is just it draws you in, and then just the performances and the editing, it just all comes together so well.
Yes, I mean Boyd was a character that a lot of people liked very much, and wonderful man, great actor, but in these genre shows, characters have to die sometimes,
right.
Even the good ones, and. And I think the music paid great homage to that sort of that scene and great respect for that scene.
Absolutely.
It's a sad way to die, though. I mean, by your placed on there.
Oh, yes, and by your pack leader, no less. You know,
yeah.
You have to
that's clearly going to affect Derek.
Derek was a little upset by it.
I have a feeling that he's going to be changed from this.
A little traumatic.
But we, a little traumatic.
We see the Mountain Ash keeping Scott from Deaton, and thank goodness Sheriff Stilinski put his skills to use, and he realized they were
at the vault. Yeah.
That was a great shot.
Marksmanship, yeah.
And he gets Deaton down, and then, so Deaton's the first victim to actually survive being taken. Perhaps
he had about a minute to go. He was
right.
He was close.
He was out of strength. He could not lift himself anymore. But do you guys think he got a glimpse of the druid or had some other clues? Because he's like the first survivor. Because normally once they're taken, like, that's it. They're going to be found. So maybe do you think he got a glimpse of something?
I mean, I guess we'll find out. I feel like he has some owning up to do next episode. But he better tell us some things.
Yeah.
Like,
what are you going to say?
Well, I was going to say he did get a glimpse of Scott's eyes.
He is the first non-werewolf, who has witnessed. But, I mean, he's known about Scott.
Yeah.
And there's many unspoken things that but he now realizes Scott is a true alpha.
Right.
One from virtue and character.
Yes.
And, but what I love about that scene is that he, from the first time he met Scott, he knew it. He knew this young man had
potential,
had a quality, had that,
had will and potential.
Yeah,
to be.
It's quite an extraordinary story.
Mm-hmm. I love Deaton. He's just sort of like Mr. Miyagi, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Doc Brown, in one.
Yeah. And I think even in the pilot, it was never really intended, probably, that his role would become so important.
Right.
And he's such a terrific actor, and
grew.
And it happens in many times. I know, in a number of shows, like in Breaking Bad, for example, the co-partner, the young guy,
Jesse,
was actually going to be killed off in some of the earlier episodes.
Yeah.
And he was so good, they
rewrote it.
They kept him in.
Well, I think fans have gained more of a power in television in general. And they're very active about what they think and how
especially
they feel.
Teen Wolf, yes.
So
if they get there in time.
Right. That's true.
But yes, I've seen it in TV as well, like other shows besides Breaking Bad. Like, I know True Blood had the same with characters, and that's a show where a bunch of people
Game
are always
Thrones.
Being killed off.
Yeah, and Walking Dead, too.
No one can save anyone in Game of Thrones, so that's a story.
So, Scott, how do you think, like, he's having this realization now that he's becoming an alpha? Like, he's gotten the glimpse in the mirror a few times of his red eyes, but I don't think he's believed it. So now, like, what's he going to do with this realization now that he is becoming an alpha?
I feel like he's going to be... I feel like it's going to add more pressure on him and more of a protective pressure, because now he knows that Deucalion's after him
and not Derek.
So anything that really happens to Derek or any of Derek's pact is in a way kind of more on his shoulders.
Right. Why is Deucalion after Scott now? Is it because only the one true alpha can defeat the demon wolf?
I mean, it's something. Probably, like, the one true alpha has...
She's something.
Special powers.
He's something. There's something.
Okay, so getting into our last topic. Our last topic for the evening is Derek. And we have Kali coming for Derek because he killed Ennis. But let's not forget it wasn't actually Derek who killed Ennis. It was Deucalion.
Yeah.
So she still doesn't know that.
Redirect her anger issues.
All right. And boy,
that was nasty.
Yeah. How was it directing that splashing and the scene? I know we talked about the struggles earlier, but...
Oh, yeah, that loft.
Because you probably weren't... Did you go down in the water, or were you
up
on a high
rise? I'm always in the water. I'm always in the blood. I mean, it's funny. I think they call me the bucket of blood director, because... I mean, sometimes I get, that would be squirting a little psh, psh, and I'll get, oh, no, boom. I throw the bucket on the wall. So they try to keep me away from the blood. Because, oh, no, Russell's got the blood. Oh, God.
And you just dump it out on everyone. I love that.
Yeah.
I can just see you.
Including myself.
Shooting everyone. Fire hose, Russell.
I remember again, back to Tales of the Crypt, we were doing an episode where this guy was being chainsawed. And there's blood spray, and I'm filming it. And I'm obviously covered in blood, up in Griffith Park. And we finished filming, and I jumped in my car. I didn't realize I was covered in blood. And drove home, but I stopped at the 7-Eleven on the way and went inside. And the guy sort of just dove behind the counter. And I went, what? And I looked at myself, and I was drenched in blood. It looked like I'd massacred everyone's dog. And, yeah.
So, did you tell him? I just
went, yeah, yeah, it's movie blood,
No.
And he went,
that's awesome. So, you know, Boyd came up with this plan, which unfortunately didn't work. And then in the end, after Derek is forced to kill his own member, we kind of see that he's able to see Boyd's memories and get that last scene that, I guess, Erica actually fought Kali, and Kali is the reason that Erica's dead. So that's even... that's going to make Derek want to get revenge on Kali even more now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the three biggest things that I took away from this scene were, well, one, I really liked their moment together and his tragic, sad death. But the fact that we saw Erica mention the lunar eclipse, which was now mentioned like five times this episode, I think
it's
a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Also that, now I just totally lost my train of thought, guys. But that, oh, I had a question. Why didn't, when he was electrocuted by the water at that one point, why didn't he shift back? Because I thought electric shock made them stop shifting.
Maybe because he's an alpha. I don't know.
I don't know.
I'm the alpha now.
That was my only question, but...
yeah, they're stronger, I guess.
How do you think Derek will be affected by killing one of his own packs? By
I think
killing
he's going to be stronger. Sad, but stronger.
I mean, this is really traumatic. Obviously, it's going to affect his character.
Yeah, it's a nice little callback to what Deucalion was saying in, I believe it was 304, when he's talking about absorbing the power of a beta, of one of his betas. And so a very dramatic callback to that scene, because that's what essentially Derek is doing, is absorbing Boyd's power, and his eyes surge a brighter red, as you see.
Yeah. So hopefully it's not like a drug and it's addicting.
It seems that way. I mean, he's surprised by it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, it's actually very Highlander, isn't it? When you cut someone's head off and you suck in the power and, yes.
They get that from you?
No. Yeah.
I'm just kidding. So.
I think it's a universal concept.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let's
cut off someone's just, head, I get impale strong. Someone.
You just suck in their karma.
Yeah. And Mrs. Blake got to see Derek turn. Is that what you were going to say?
I was going to say just the fact that we see Mrs. Blake definitely have a weakening effect on Derek. And
but she can heal him. But she weakens him.
Some love.
But she can heal him. But she weakens him. That's how love is. Before we go into
universal
concept, right there.
Definitely, girls.
Before we go into the interview with Russell, I just want to say that you guys can. You're doing an awesome job of supporting AfterBuzz and commenting on the videos and downloading on iTunes. You can call into the show. Don't forget at 424-256-1729. We have the fan line open. You can join our live chat at AfterBuzz TV. I just want to read a few names and comments. We had Antonio Wilson say, can you please mention this in next episode if you can? Say hi to the cast, and every single one of them are just so wonderful and that they really deserve to be on the show. You're awesome for their awesome acting. Please mention this. I really want them to know my name is Antonio Wilson from Georgia. Thank you, Antonio. We read your comment.
Yep.
They all know.
They know.
They want to thank you, Russell.
They would appreciate that. Yeah. Seriously.
And Derek Johnson says he absolutely loves the episode. He loves the different horror elements, and he loved that they get to see the more human side of Ethan with the Danny interactions, and that he's basically willing to turn Danny into a werewolf if it can help him, and that he believes they'll fall in love. And we had so many other great comments. We have Joseph, we have BX Girls, we have Hecklin Lover, Josh Channing, username maybe.
Her favorite is. I'm not quite
who
sure.
Knows? Yeah. Haley Colbert, Brianne, Hayward, Wolfswind, Buru Raven, Lou Nady, Derek Johnson. Thank you guys all so much for your comments, and continue to leave us feedback. If we can make the show better for you, let us know how. All right, guys, I'd like to get into the exclusive interview with Russell. We're so excited for you to be here. And I normally ask everybody at the beginning of the interview what aspects from their childhood do they think have sort of contributed to, you know, them wanting to be in the career choice that they made. So what do you think from your childhood, just maybe a specific story or something, kind of led you into wanting to direct?
It was a couple of things, I guess. In Australia, growing up, horror films were banned up until about 1969, I think.
That's so crazy.
There was a ban on horror films and also certain novels, and then this book came. And so when I was a young kid, my mum would tell me stories. She came from England, and she'd seen a lot of the films. And so over breakfast, she would tell me House of Wax and Frankenstein and these films she'd seen. And I was fascinated. I'd say, tell me another one. Tell me another one. And she'd tell me about the toe wiggling in the wax. And she was very graphic the way she told them. And the mummy and all that. So I grew up with these sort of just these images in my own head and had never seen the films. Then the ban was lifted, and there's a flood of all the films, and I saw them all. But it wasn't until I went to the drive-in cinema and saw a film called The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, and it's sort of a hokey. Hang on, I should not say that word. Ray Harryhausen. But as soon as I saw the Cyclops come around the cliff, and I was like 9 years old or 8 years old or something, and I went, I want to be able to do that. And it was from there, you know. I bought a Nemo camera. I was like 12 and started making little films.
Do you remember the plot of one of the first films that you made?
Yes, it was called Vampire Island. It starred three people, but one of us had to operate the camera. So there's only ever two people in shot. So it'd be like two guys were on the beach, and then I'd crawl to the beach. And we had fabulous cardboard teeth, and yeah. But it wasn't
Oscar
quite finished because one guy jumped off a rock and broke his foot, and the film.
You should have filmed
the
that
film
part.
Was wrapped.
Reality.
It was incomplete. It was a bit like, yeah.
You didn't have a stunt team in there.
Terry Gilliam film, you know. Like, Johnny Depp, but yeah, it was like, yeah.
So,
complete disaster, financial disaster.
Talking about your earlier work, as a writer, I sometimes feel like I should go back to some of my earlier work because maybe that was a good idea. Do you feel like, as a director now, do you ever like reflect on ideas you had when you were a kid or your younger work and try to recreate that and come up with projects to incorporate those ideas?
Yeah, I mean, during the hiatus, I think between, it was between doing the pilot until it was picked up, I actually wrote a film called Bait 3D about sharks in a supermarket. There's a
awesome.
Tsunami and sharks. I know there's, what is it called, Sharktopus or no,
Sharknado.
Sharknado?
Yeah.
Actually, Bait's a little better than that. But anyway, so I wrote this thing and I produced it and they filmed it in Australia. It's in 3D and you can get it on DVD, Blu-ray, 3D. And so we did that. So it was good to write something. It got that out of my system and I didn't get to direct it because I had Team Wolf got picked up, and I went, mm-hmm. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I just got to go back and do my bet, you know.
Yeah. No, that's great.
That.
So I know you've been there from season one. So how has your directing process changed over the journey from season one of Teen Wolf to season three?
Every day is different. You know, every day is an adventure because every story is so different. Jeff comes up with these just wonderful, crazy ideas. And so it really is, there's never a dull moment. It's just, you get there, I have my two quad cappuccinos and you know, we just go for the 16 hours, bang, and we're...
What's one of your best memories on set of Teen Wolf? Or in general.
I think it was, then there's a photograph of Jeff and I standing outside on the pilot on day one. And we're about to shoot our first scene and the makeup trailer behind us is on fire.
And we went,
oh, this is a good omen. And then on the same pilot, we're down in the gully in the forest shooting the scene, and there was a flash flood. And I said, no, keep filming. And the rain's pouring down, the river is rising, but it was pitch black, and da da da. And eventually the producer had to grab me and pull me out of there, and there's people trying up this mountain and people getting run over by ATVs, and we lost the, not lives, but we lost a lot of lights and it was an escape from a flooded valley. It was quite extraordinary.
So then
the actual scene of the girl when he's got the in the pilot in the first, when he's got the iPhone out and he's looking for the body,
mm-hmm.
or he's looking for his inhaler and he finds the half corpse,
mm-hmm.
yeah. That body was actually shot in the catering tent because it was raining so heavy outside.
Oh, wow.
So Jeff and I got a shovel and dug a hole in the ground, and we got the girl, covered, put the prosthetics on it, and we shot her, moved the dinner tables aside. Shot that while I was pissing down with rain, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Make it work.
On set.
You just got to make it work. You got to go with the flow, and sometimes you make it work with smoke and mirrors. But the most important thing is to tell the story. Tell the story well. They're great scripts, and my responsibility as a director is to tell it as efficiently and as entertainingly and as visually interesting as possible, mm-hmm. and just have much fun doing it, and create that sense on set too, because we have a lot of creative people on the set and in post production, and this guy did an extraordinary job in those scenes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I mean, I didn't even know you'd cut them.
Oh yeah, no.
Until I saw them and I went, wow, you did a great job, and he said, I didn't cut them. Corey got them.
Oh, that was nice.
Man!
Yeah.
You got a job.
Thank you very much.
Russell, right. You've worked with so many artists as well. What's, like, your favorite music video that you ever made? You've made so many.
My God. I like the Wild Boys only because it's attached to a novel that I really want to film, The Wild Boys by William Burroughs. And I had the rights to that novel for a while, and then Duran came and asked me to do the song, if they could write a song called The Wild Boys, and I said, yes, as long as I can incorporate some images that I want to do in the movie. And so we did the video. So I'm quite attached to that. But then just being good friends with Elton, I like most of the Elton stuff I did, like I'm Still Sandy, and that's why I called the blues. Billy Joel, Allentown, whatever.
That's awesome. What's one of your goals or another project that you want to do in the future? I know you said you wanted to film that
The Wild Boys, yeah.
Is there something else that you kind of look as a future goal that you want to accomplish?
We're working on a thriller horror film,
mm-hmm.
So hopefully, next year we'll do that in one of the hiatuses. I mean, thrillers, suspense, horrors is a great genre that I love and adore. So, yeah.
We all do. Mm. Russell, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
For being here tonight and all your contributions to the show. We just all love this show, and it's thanks to you and the other great cast and crew members.
Well, put your seatbelts on because it's you're in for quite a ride for the next five episodes.
Let's talk about the next five episodes, Sarah. What predictions do you have? We can go ahead and roll into predictions.
I mean, I think I've kind of hinted at my predictions already.
Do we need spooky music now?
Oh, we do.
Predictions.
Oh my God, you've got to go.
Yeah.
Something else, right?
I definitely think that Deaton's going to have to come clean, mm-hmm. about what he knows a little bit. I also think that we're going to get more information about the lunar eclipse, or that's eventually, when that happens, I think that's going to be a really big episode or a big factor. And I really think that the tree that Lydia drew is going to come into play somewhere down the line. So
I think those are very good predictions. I think next week we get to see that Derek was changed by a girl, and we get to see his past. And I feel like he's being changed by Jennifer Blake now. So maybe there's some parallels there that we'll get to see. And Scott goes to Gerard, it looks like, for the truth and maybe some advice about the story, about Deucalion, what's going on. And he says that Deucalion can't be beaten. But I also don't think that he knows that Scott's the one true alpha. So that will help, I think. And my last prediction, I think Scott's mom and Stiles' dad, I think there's some romance there. And I think
really?
She's going to help Stilinski's...
To become real brothers?
I know. Real brothers, yes. No, I think that she's going to help him cope with the truth about the werewolves in the town. So maybe some romance will stir out of that.
That would be interesting.
All right, guys. Well, that's it for this week. I'm Kristen Elizabeth Snyder. You can find me at Cinematic Escape on Twitter, or you can Bing my blog, Cinematic Escape. Sarah, where can we find you?
You can find me here next Sunday for True Blood.
And Corey, what's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is Corey Trench, and also my band's Twitter is Articles_Music, and Articles Rock and Roll on Facebook.
And Russell, where can
I'm
we find
on,
your
I'm
band?
On his.
Can we find your Twitter? I follow you today.
Just go to him,
today.
And he'll write me a note.
Yeah.
Okay. Tweet Corey, and he'll get your tweets to Russell, who I do believe is on
answer.
Twitter.
Yeah, he will.
All right, guys, that's it for this week. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.
From Bing.com, executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.